Welcome to a very special Bomblet edition of Bombshell. I am Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I'm a very croaky Aaron Simpson.
And we are here recording on Wednesday after the election. We usually record on Sundays, but decided to, instead of just guessing wrong on everything that was going to happen, to wait until after the election to talk a little bit about what the 2018 election means for foreign policy and national security. We do not typically talk about Congress because they have their own problems and we've got enough to mess with in terms of the executive branch. But shockingly, perhaps shockingly to Congress, they should and can play a pretty big role in both the defense and national security and foreign policy and also trade space. So we wanted to do a couple of things in this short episode. First, give a quick overview of who's who in the brand new zoo, particularly on the House side. Secondly, to talk about what the election means for defense spending, defense budgeting. And then lastly, just talk about oversight more broadly. Oversight's a bit of a foreign concept in Congress these days, but we'll see what they do this time around. From the AUMF to trade to sanctions, that Congress could, in this instance, with a changeover in party, play a pretty significant role. So starting up at the top, looking at our results, Aaron, who is this new Congress? Who are we welcoming to our fair city?
Well, that's a good question. As I think everyone probably knows by now, the Democrats took the House last night and will have the new majority there. The Republicans held on in the Senate and, in fact, actually gained some seats, and we'll talk about that here in a second. Of the many seats that the Democrats flipped, and a lot of those were in districts that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, there's actually quite a few veterans, but actually quite a few national security alumni from a variety of agencies. So we have Mickey Sherrill out of New Jersey, along with Tom Malinowski. We also have Alyssa Slotkin winning a race in Michigan, Abigail Spanberger in Virginia. And I think late breaking this afternoon was that Andy Kim, I think, was pulling ahead, but was still kind of neck and neck in his New Jersey race as well. So there's kind of an interesting mix. We're still waiting on Martha McSally's race out in Arizona on the Senate side to see just how many folks will be here coming in January. But it's an interesting mix on the House side. On the Senate side, there's a handful of races that might be of interest to folks. In particular, there are three Democrats from the Senate Armed Services Committee who lost last night. That's Claire McCaskill, Joe Donnelly, and more or less Bill Nelson, although it sounds like there's going to be a recount on the Florida Senate race, and so we'll see just what exactly comes out on that side. Turns out domestic politics are rather complicated. But we have kind of, that'll make some big changes on the SASC as some junior members we'll get a new ranking member and have some new leadership opportunities for Democrats potentially there.
So in terms of committees, particularly on the House side, for those who do not track Congress on a day-to-day basis, the fact that we've switched parties and are also switching chairs of the various committees also means that you are switching over professional staff in most cases. And the professional staff who support committees, these are folks that they effectively report to the whole committee, but also really report to the chair himself or herself. So whoever the chair is has a potential to really kind of change the flavor of what the agenda is for the committee in the upcoming congressional session, but also the kind of staffing expertise that are brought to bear for all of the issues that are really important to them. So I guess at the top of the list for me is thinking about, we're going from the House Armed Services Committee, Mac Thornberry, who is a frankly kind of an interesting but technocratic, really sort of process and organizationally focused chair, over to his Democratic counterpart, most likely Adam Smith. And everything that I'm guessing is that he will probably have a different view on budget than his Republican predecessor and maybe some other priorities. What about the HPSI? This is the part, I think, the one that's going to be the most fascinating.
Yeah. So, Adam Schiff, who has been a pretty vocal critic of the current administration, as well as pretty invested in the Russia investigation, will be taking over as chair. And that has the potential to do a couple of things. One is obviously there's the ongoing Russia investigation, subject of the Mueller investigation at DOJ, but there's also a broader counterintelligence investigation that has been ongoing since the 2016 election, doesn't get as much play, trying to better understand foreign interference in our electoral systems, electoral sort of integrity. And I think, you know, Adam Schiff was pretty clear, even when being interviewed last night right after the election, that these were going to be areas of focus for him and that election integrity was a really important issue and one that he thinks as a HPSE chair they should take seriously. I would also note, obviously, the intel services themselves have taken a little bit in the chin with critiques from the administration. It'll be interesting to see how the sort of additional oversight and or support from Congress sort of bolster some of those intelligence reports and processes in a world where the president seems more skeptical of their findings than maybe their oversight in on the Hill.
More importantly, Devin Nunes is no longer chairman of this committee, which is a great,
thank God,
a great gain for the Republic, in my opinion.
Though many fewer jokes for us, so trade-off.
Sadly. On the appropriations side, we have likely chair of the HAC-D will be Pete Viscoloski of Indiana. God, that's a great name, who I know basically nothing about, but will play presumably a fairly intensive role in building what the defense budget, the size and the composition of the defense budget. Any other chairs of note, ladies?
Yeah, so we often forget, but the House Ways and Means Committee actually owns our trade oversight and trade relations, and that will be taken over by Richard Neal, who's from Massachusetts. And he is a very interesting guy, actually, voted against NAFTA back in the day. He's a pretty moderate Democrat coming from Massachusetts. And so seeing how and when the Ways and Means Committee starts to sort of take an interest in some of our tariffs and tax issues will be something that we want to keep an eye on, and we can talk about a little more.
So we don't know yet. There's all kinds of rumors afloat about whether or not anyone's going to seriously challenge Nancy Pelosi in terms of her speakership. I think there's a lot of desire by some of the incoming Democrats to rethink this. Some of them even campaigned openly on this matter. But regardless, I think the flavor of Congress is going to change. We're going to have more women. As Aaron pointed out, we're going to have, if not more veterans, different veterans, as well as foreign policy veterans in place. For the first time, we're going to have two Muslim women who will be sworn into Congress.
And two Native American women, one from my home district in Kansas.
Oh, that's right. I think that there are a few different races that are still kind of potentially on hold right now. We are decidedly looking at a new and different kind of Congress on the House side here in Washington. So obviously, the most important thing to us super budget nerds here is, what does this mean for the $716 billion defense budget in the next Congress?
Someone's going to have some splaining to do, right, Aaron?
Well, you know, minor note, we're actually have several agencies still on a continuing resolution for this year. So there's actually some budget work to do in the current Congress before we get to the new Congress in January. I mean, the budget piece is interesting. Certainly, Adam Smith has talked about trying to rein in defense spending. He's unhappy with several of the larger defense procurement programs. What I have my eye on is we're actually still under the Budget Control Act for the next 2 years, at least the next two budget cycles. And there's an increasingly kind of yawning gap between what the BCA caps say we should spend and the kinds of deals that actually get brokered. So one of the reasons we were able to really blow through those BCA caps last year was that there was a Republican president and two Republican houses of Congress that came to agreement to just blow them wide open. Next year, it's harder to see what that deal might look like, right? So the Democratic House, led by something like Nancy Pelosi and Adam Smith on the defense side, is going to have to come to some sort of deal with a very Republican Senate. And, you know, James Inhofe is still the, you know, SASC chair on the Senate side. So I don't really know what their overlapping preferences are, but it seems somewhat small. And that all kind of gets balanced out by the general Democratic preference to balance military spending and domestic spending, which has often been a non-starter on the Republican side. So kind of with split houses, the chances of coming to a really good deal are going to be challenging, and we could potentially see a continuing resolution that just lasts all of fiscal year 2021.
My colleague Susanna Bloom brings up a good point that, like, this is the matter of, like, how big the defense budget is frankly not going to be at the top of the list in terms of what House Democrats want to focus on in the upcoming Congress. I mean, they're larger priorities in terms of, oversight of the president, possible investigations. They're not going to want to spend tremendous political capital in figuring out how to keep the defense budget in a place that is satisfactory to the sort of center sides of both parties, while also trying to keep domestic spending to some degree on par with that, which has been kind of the goal over the last several budget cycle arguments. I think the potential for a gridlock, the potential for budget shutdowns, politically motivated budget shutdowns, goes back up again. It's likely not going to be a super fun season for those in the Pentagon who are already frustrated that the president cut what their kind of hold steady budget was going to be for the upcoming fiscal years.
Yeah, and I think just like to maybe wrap up that point, it does sort of maintain this cycle of budget uncertainty and chaos in these defense budgets, that in a world where, like, including the most recent nuclear posture review, there's a lot of long-term sort of capital investment and spending planning that needs to be made. And this certainly doesn't, do a lot to help ease that uncertainty cycle.
One idea that I had that I don't love, but I could see easily being plausible, is to help everyone save some face. Effectively, let the president submit a $700 billion total national defense budget. To the degree that there are disagreements over wanting to go over that or anything else, just hide the remainder in OCO. Even though we've been talking about getting rid of OCO since the dawn of time, might as well just continue to use it as a slush fund so that we won't have to have too many political arguments over what we're actually spending on defense.
And remind our listeners what OCO is.
Overseas contingency operations, which, by the way, we have a lot of overseas contingency operations, but we also spend a lot of money in that account that are not overseas contingency operations.
That is correct, aka the slush fund.
Speaking of overseas operations, oversight. I think that,
Wait, what is that? How does that work?
That's a great question. Congress hasn't really engaged in it in a while, but if they wanted to look at their constitutional responsibilities, they might find that they have a role in the declaration of war and may want to kind of give it a shot. Just, test it out, see what it's like, see if it fits.
I spent so much of my life understanding when, under legal authorities, the U.S. could engage in military force and how to convince other people of it. And I just feel like the Democrats, if they really want some oversight, we could all talk about the AUMF again. So this, for those who remember, is the 2001 authorization use of military force, which allowed us to, fight the Taliban in Afghanistan immediately after 9/11. And it's currently arguably the foundation of our global counterterrorism operations, all of them in all of the places, regardless of how they're related to the Taliban. But, I digress. There has been a more widespread effort by the current administration to have special operations forces specifically and more broadly the U.S. military engaged in a range of targeted operations related to global threats. And those have largely had sort of devolved decision-making down to commanders. We saw some issues in Niger with the death of soldiers there. We've seen insider attacks in Afghanistan relatively recently. So I think there's some questions that the House Armed Services Committee certainly could start asking in terms of what is the reason we are deploying troops to an area? What is the objective? Under what legal authority is this operation happening? What are the rules of engagement for the troops? And what are the risks we're putting our forces in relative to the national security gain? And I think these are debates we actually haven't had in a couple of years, and probably for a healthy functioning democracy that sends its men and women into harm's way, we probably should be having in a more robust way.
Could we also have some hearings where we start with the question of how many troops are in Afghanistan or Syria?
Because apparently that is a secret.
It is a secret.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of frustration more broadly with, just how much the Pentagon is keeping behind closed doors and their reluctance to do public briefings. And I don't know if we're going to get public hearings on all of these matters, but I think quite a few folks are probably going to get pulled up to the hill and forced to, offer an accounting on a few of these issues.
Now, an area that I think has a lot of potential for fairly quick action is to constrain or potentially cut off altogether U.S. support for the coalition, Saudi and UAE coalition in Yemen, that has some There were a couple of different provisions put forward in over the last several months to either constrain the U.S. ability to provide arms sales, to constrain their ability to provide intelligence or their other operational support, to particularly to Saudi Arabia, in large part due to the tremendous civilian casualties that are taking place within these operations, as well as the larger humanitarian crisis going on. I think that there's real potential for at least the House Democrats lining up behind this and some bipartisan support as well. Whether or not we should be focusing on that versus our 17-year war in Afghanistan or other priorities, I don't know. But that at minimum has gotten more traction than I think a lot of people who work in this space otherwise might have imagined. But more importantly, Radha, what can Congress have fun with on trade now?
Yes. So I'm so glad you asked, as I'm sure our listeners are shocked to learn. So as I mentioned earlier, the House Ways and Means actually has a really important role to play in trade. So it has two big buckets of things it can do. One is establishing tariffs and drafting and implementing trade agreements. So that's like one bucket, and they have a trade subcommittee that actually does that. The other is like investigating and providing oversight on policies and executive actions that impact U.S. global competitiveness, like, say, using national security exemptions to tax lots of Chinese goods. And so you saw the Democrats sort of earlier this year, you know, issue a statement when the president added additional taxes on the Chinese goods, asking for explanations on these and estimates showing the impact on U.S. farmers and ranchers. You actually saw the Ways and Means drafted the tariff relief bill that would come out to the floor to try to help farmers deal with some of the adjustment costs of those. And so you can see that actually there's a pretty big potential for the House Democrats to have a lot of influence on trade decisions that the administration makes and actually undercut some of the tariffs that they're making. Just one other big quick note, which is like trade agreements that they sign have to be approved by Congress, and those trade agreements and trade authorities go through the House Ways and Means. So if we want to say redraft NAFTA, that new bill has to go through Congress and that process goes through the House Ways and Means. So that's another just important oversight mechanism that I think we'll see more on, given how active they were, even when they didn't really have any oversight capabilities. Now we should see a lot more action.
And I think one thing that's easy to overlook is, you know, it's an oversight function, but it's also a bit of political theater, which is the ability to hold hearings on pretty much any topic the committee chairman or chairwoman wants. And so, you know, that means, you know, you could have, you know, Adam Smith having, you know, hearings on the future of nuclear posture. You could have, you know, should we join the TPP? They can call, you know, invite any number of expert witnesses. They can request participation from the administration or demand answers on, you know, different kinds of things. And, you know, that is the sort of thing that generates, it probably doesn't last that long in the news cycle, and it probably only really matters in kind of some narrow Washington circles. But to the degree to which that can shift conversation on policy issues and affect debate, or, you know, even, you know, generate a few different hits on the cable news piece, I think that those are, you know, that is part of the thing that will change the tenor on some of these foreign policy and national security discussions, because you'll actually have, you know, Democrats being able to hold court and hopefully use that to hold people accountable, but at minimum generate some political theater.
Yeah, and that actually probably will be super important on the domestic security side too, right? Mm. Border control, mm-hmm. separated families. That makes both is probably a really important area for oversight. Like, I would love to have some hearings and oversight on how we're reuniting separated families consistent with court orders. But I think it also gives the Democrats a bully pulpit to sort of change the conversation in the way the president sometimes does. How effectively they'll be able to do that remains to be seen, but it's certainly an area that has potential for influence.
You know, one area exactly within that space that I'll be interested to see how it works out is Congress will effectively be able to call departments and agencies, I'm thinking particularly the State Department, the Department of Defense, call them out when they are not acting in line with what the president's guidance was. And obviously, I think in many cases, House Democrats in particular may actually support departments and agencies doing a bit of shirking in terms of their duties. But right now, because of the facts, you don't see Pompeo and Mattis and their agencies being terribly public about their actions and intent and overall strategies. If Congress uses their ability to call hearings and force people onto the carpet, you may see the president realize increasingly that there are a number of issues where he has given tweets or public statements or rants to the press in some way where he expected follow-up and action that are being a bit slow-rolled by both of these agencies, perhaps with, you know, good intent or just because of, you know, bureaucratic nonsense. And to see his reaction to that, particularly since he's apparently in a firing mood since he got canned Jeff Sessions today, will be interesting to watch how that impacts the president's oversight of his own departments and agencies.
It's going to be so much fun.
It's going to be delightful.
So much to watch. I feel like we're going to learn a lot about the various authorities of committees. That's what I'm looking forward to the most.
Well, we're certainly going to have to listen to a lot of like lawfare podcasts because a lot of this is going to come down to just how much executive agencies and cabinet officials in particular can refuse to show up before a committee when they've been asked. And, you know, all of the fun that goes along with that. I think most of the high drama will be reserved for the Russia investigation and maybe some of the counterintelligence pieces that go along with that. But
yeah, I could use an explainer on like the subpoena power and subsequent enforcement from Congress. So Lawfare, if you're listening, feel free to do that.
Oh, I'm sure one of those will be forthcoming.
So since this was a short episode, we don't have any pop culture. I will mention one thing. Next week is the NatSec Girl Squad conference on November 15th. I believe the conference itself is sold out, but the after party where Lawfare will be doing a live show with several favorite guests of ours and theirs, I think is still open. So check it out online. And then I want to just pay due deference to RADA for her love of data. And thank you for the one time of year that we really care about it.
That's right. I just want to point out that everyone makes fun of the best use of data and statistics all year. What's your favorite statistical distribution? And then all of a sudden for 2 weeks, everyone's talking about sampling bias and response bias and forecasting models. Guys, it's a year-long skill. Take a stats class. Happy to chat.
So with that, anything else, ladies?
I think we'll hold for a week or so here and see what the winds of change bring.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this low yield bomblet that was not attached to an intermediate range nuclear weapon, but was. I'm sorry. But we'll be back in a week and a half with your regularly scheduled episode, and we'll talk then.
Bye.